was dreadful. He'd test first with the toe of his crampon, kicking gently until he heard rock or ice, and then press his heel directly onto that spot. Twice he felt his balance teeter, but managed both times to right himself before reaching the narrow ledge beyond. He paused, his forehead resting against the rock, until he felt composed enough to drive a piton into the face. He got the rope rigged through it. Mimo pulled back the slack, and the rope was taut, like a banister. The wind gusted. The whiteout returned. They were visually separated for more than a minute. When it calmed, and he was able to make out the others back on the other side of the catwalk, they looked ghostly. Pino swallowed hard.
"Send Anthony first!"
Anthony held on to the taut rope with his right hand and put his boots exactly in Pino's prints. He was across in a minute. Judith followed her brother, holding on to the rope and putting her boots in Pino's prints. They accomplished the task with relative ease. Mrs. D'Angelo came next. She froze between the avalanche chutes, looking hypnotized. Then her young son called out,
"Come on, Mama! You can do it."
She pushed on, and when she reached the ledge, she wrapped her arms around her children and cried. Mr. D'Angelo came next and accomplished the feat in seconds. He explained that he'd done gymnastics as a boy. The wind gusted before Mrs. Napolitano could begin the journey. Pino cursed to himself. He knew that the mental trick to crossing something like the catwalk was to not think about it until you were actually in motion. But she couldn't help thinking about it now. Her ascent of the chimney, however, seemed to have emboldened Mrs. Napolitano, because when the wind ebbed and the visibility returned, she started across without Pino's prompting. When she was 3/4 of the way across the catwalk, the wind picked up again, and she vanished in swirling white.
"Don't move a muscle!"
Pino shouted into the void.
"Wait it out!"
Mrs. Napolitano did not reply. He kept testing the line gently, feeling the weight of her out there until, at last, the wind dropped, and she was standing there coated in snow, as still as a statue. When she reached the ledge, she held on to Pino tightly for several moments and said,
"I don't think I've ever been that scared in my life. I know I haven't prayed that hard in my life."
"Your prayers were answered," he said, patting her on the back, and then whistling for his brother. With one end of the long rope tightly knotted around his brother's waist, and Pino ready to take in slack, he said,
"Ready?" "I was born ready,"
Mimo replied, and set off quick and sure.
"Slow down," Pino said, trying to pull the slack rope through the piton and carabiner as fast as possible.
Mimo was already between the two avalanche chutes.
"Why?" he says. "Father Ray says I'm part mountain goat."
Those words had no sooner left Mimo's mouth than he stumbled slightly. His right foot shot out too far and broke through. There was a sound like someone plumping a pillow. Then the snow in the chute swirled and slid like water cycling down a drain, and to Pino's horror, his little brother went with it, vanishing into a whirlpool of white.
Chapter 11 1
"Mimo!"
Pino yelled and heaved back on the rope. His brother's weight jerked in the void and almost pulled Pino off his feet.
"Help!"
Pino cried to Mr. D'Angelo. Mrs. Napolitano got there first, grabbed hold of the line behind Pino with her mittens, and threw her weight backward. The rope held. The load held.
"Mimo!"
Pino shouted.
"Mimo!"
No answer. The wind gusted, and with it the world above the avalanche chute whited out once more.
"Mimo!"
he screamed. Silence for a moment, and then came a weak, shaken voice.
I'm here. Jesus, get me up. There's nothing but a lot of air below me. I think I'm going to be sick.
Pino hauled against the rope, but it gave no ground.
My pack's caught on something, Mimo said. Lower me a little.
Mr. D'Angelo had taken Mrs. Napolitano's place by then, and though he hated to give up any ground in a situation like this, Pino reluctantly let the rope slide through his leather gloves.
Got it, Mimo said.
They heaved and pulled and brought Mimo to the lip. Pino tied off the rope and had Mr. D'Angelo pin his legs down so he could reach over to grab his brother's rucksack. Seeing Mimo's hat was gone, seeing him bleeding from a nasty head cut, and seeing how the chute fell away below him, Pino surged with adrenaline and hoisted his brother onto the ledge. The two brothers sat against the rock face, chests heaving.
Don't ever do that again, Pino said at last. Mama and Papa would never forgive me. I'd never forgive me.
Mimo gasped.
I think that's the nicest thing you've ever said to me.
Pino threw his arm around his brother's neck and hugged him once and hard.
Okay, okay, Mimo protested. Thanks for saving my life.
You'd do the same.
Of course, Pino. We're brothers. Always.
Pino nodded, feeling like he'd never loved his brother as much as he did right then. Mrs. D'Angelo knew some first aid. She used snow to clean out the scalp wound and staunch the blood flow. They tore pieces of a scarf for bandages, and then wrapped the rest around Mimo's head for an improvised hat that the children said made him look like a fortune teller. The gusts slowed, but the snow fell harder as Pino led them up to that ledge along the low neck of the crag.
We can't climb that, Mr. D'Angelo said, craning his head up at the peak, which was like an icy spearhead above them.
We're going around it, Pino said. He pressed his stomach to the wall and started to step sideways. Just before he rounded the corner where the ledge dropped 19 or 20 centimeters in width, he looked back at Mrs. Napolitano and the others.
There's a cable here. It's iced up, but you'll be able to grip it. I want you to hold it, right hand knuckles up, left hand knuckles down, above and below, right? Do not, under any circumstances, release your grip until you reach the other side.
Other side of what?
Mrs. Napolitano asked. Pino glanced toward the wall and down, saw that snow blocked any real view of what was a very, very long fall, an unlivable fall.
The rock wall will be right in front of your nose, Pino said. Look in front of you and sideways, but not behind you or down.
I'm not going to like this, am I?
The violinist asked.
I'll bet you didn't like the first night you played at La Scala, but you did it, and you can do this.
Despite the frost on her face, she licked her lips, shuddered, and then nodded.
2.
After everything they'd been through, crossing the face via the cable and ledge proved easier than Pino expected. But that side of the peak was southeast-facing and lured to the storm. All 5 refugees and Mimo came across without further incident. Pino collapsed in the snow, thanking God for watching over them and praying that they'd seen the worst. But the winds picked up again. Not in gusts, but with steady force that drove the snowflakes into their faces like icy needles. The farther northeast they trudged, the worse the storm got, until Pino wasn't exactly sure where he was. Of all the obstacles they'd faced since leaving Casa Alpina that morning, moving blind in a snowstorm across an open ridge was the most dangerous, at least where Pino was concerned. Pizzo Gropera was pocked with crevasses at that time of year. They could fall 6 meters or more into one of them and not be found until spring. Even if he could avoid the mountain's physical dangers, with the cold and wet came the threat of hypothermia and death.
I can't see,
Mrs. Napolitano said. The D'Angelo children began to cry. Judith couldn't feel her feet or hands. Pino was on the verge of panic when, ahead, out of the storm, a cairn appeared. The stack of rocks immediately oriented Pino. Ahead of them lay Val d'Ilay, but the forest was still a solid 4, maybe 5 kilometers away. Then he remembered that along the trail that climbed north from the cairn, there was another shepherd's hut with a stove.
"We can't go on until the storm lets up," Pino shouted to them. "But I know a place we can take shelter, get warm, and ride it out."
The refugees all nodded with relief. 30 minutes later, Pino and Mimo were on their hands and knees, burrowing into the snow to open the door to the hut. Pino ducked inside first and turned on the miner's lamp. Mimo made sure the stove was not booby-trapped and built a fire. Before they lit it, Pino went out into the snow once more and invited them inside, before climbing onto the roof to make sure the chimney was clear. He pressed the door shut and told his brother to light the stove. The matches caught the dry tinder, and soon the kindling and logs were ablaze. The firelight revealed the exhaustion in all their faces. Pino knew he'd made the right decision coming here and letting the storm sputter out before they pushed on. But would Mr. Bergstrom be there in the woods beyond Val d'Ilay? The Swiss man would suspect the storm had delayed their progress. He'd come back when it was over, wouldn't he? In a few moments, those questions were pushed aside. The little stove was almost red hot and throwing delicious heat into the dirt-floored, low-ceilinged hut. Mrs. D'Angelo pulled off Judith's boots and began to knead her daughter's frozen feet.
"It stings," Judith said.
"It's the blood returning," Pino said. "Sit closer to the fire and take your socks off." Soon they were all stripping down. Pino checked Mimo's head wound, which had stopped bleeding, and then got out food and drink. He heated tea on the stove, and they ate cheese and bread and salami. Mrs. Napolitano said it was the best meal of her life. Anthony fell asleep in his father's lap. Pino turned off the miner's lamp and nodded into a deep, dreamless sleep of his own. He woke long enough to see everyone else dozing around him, then checked the fire, which was down to fading embers. Hours later, a sound like a locomotive engine woke Pino. The train rumbled right at them, shook the ground, passed, and then there was nothing but a deep silence for many long seconds, broken only by the groaning and popping of the logs supporting the roof. From deep in Pino's gut, he knew they were in trouble once more.
"What was that, Pino?"
Mrs. Napolitano cried. "Avalanche," Pino said, trying to control the tremor in his voice as he groped for the miner's lamp. "It came right over the top of us." He lit the lamp. He went to the door, pulled it open, and was shaken to his core. Avalanche-hardened snow and debris completely blocked the hut's only exit. Mimo came up beside him, saw the dense wall of ice and snow, and in a terrified whisper said,
"Mary, Mother of God, Pino, it's buried us alive."
3. The hut erupted in cries and worries. Pino barely heard them. He was staring at the wall of snow and feeling like the Mother of God and God himself had betrayed him and everyone else in that hut. What good is faith now? These people just wanted safety, refuge from the storm, and instead they got... Mimo tugged his arm, said,
"What are we going to do?"
Pino stared at his brother, hearing the frightened questions the D'Angelos and Mrs. Napolitano were firing at him, and feeling completely overwhelmed. He was only 17, after all. Part of him wanted to sit against the wall, hang his head, and cry. But then the faces looking at him in the glow of the miner's lamp came back into focus. They needed him. They were his responsibility. If they died, it would be his fault. That clicked something inside him, and he looked at his watch. It was 9:45 in the morning. Air, he thought. And with that one word, his brain cleared, and he had a purpose. Everyone be quiet and still, he said, crossing to the cool stove and turning the damper. To his relief, it moved. The snow had not come that far down the chimney. Mimo, Mr. D'Angelo, help me, Pino said, as he put his gloves on and worked to free the chimney from the stove.
What are you doing?
Mrs. Napolitano asked. Trying not to suffocate.
Oh, dear God,
the violinist said.
After everything I've been through, my baby and I are going to choke to death in here.
Not if I can help it. Pino disconnected the stove and moved it aside. Then, close to the ceiling, they detached the lower section of the blackened sheet metal chimney and put it aside, too. Pino tried to shine the miner's lamp into the tube, but he couldn't see much. He held his hand across the hole, feeling for a breeze, some sign that air was getting through. Nothing. Fighting panic, he got one of his bamboo ski poles and used his knife to cut the leather and metal basket off the bottom, leaving him with the exposed steel spike. Pino pushed the ski pole up the chimney hole. It stopped when half the pole had vanished. He jabbed at the blockage. Snow dropped out and to the floor. He started jabbing and turning and probing with the ski pole, causing a steady stream of snow to fall from the tube. 5 minutes, 10 minutes. He could push the ski pole and his arm up the chimney, and it still felt blocked.
How long can we last in here without air? Mimo asked.
I have no idea, Pino said, and pulled the pole down and out again. He took a second ski pole and cut the leather pieces from the pole baskets into narrower strips. With the strips and his belt, he managed to attach the two poles end to end, spike to handle. It was a wobbly connection at best, and Pino could no longer stab as hard as he could with the single pole.
How long can we survive without air? 4, 5 hours? Less?
Mimo, Mr. D'Angelo, and Pino took turns chipping at the snow in the chimney, while Mrs. Napolitano, Mrs. D'Angelo, and the children huddled in the corner, watching. All their exertions and exhalations had turned the interior of the hut warm, almost hot. The sweat poured off Pino's head as he kept teasing the ski poles upward, chopping out snow bit by bit. 2 hours after he started, when the handle of the lower ski pole was almost to the ceiling, he hit something that felt unmovable. He kept chipping at it, but all he was getting was slivers of ice. There had to be a block of it above.
It's not going, Mimo said, frustrated.
You keep at it, Pino said, stepping aside. It was now stifling hot in the hut. Pino stripped off his shirt and felt himself struggling for breath.
Is this it?
Will it hurt, not having air? He flashed on a fish he'd seen dying on the beach at Rapallo once, how its mouth and gills had sought water, each movement smaller than the last, until there was none. Is that how we'll die? Like fish? Pino did his best to control the panic swirling in his stomach, while his brother and then Mr. D'Angelo kept chipping at the obstruction.
Please, God, he prayed. Please don't let us all die here like this. Mimo and I were trying to help these people. We don't deserve to die like this. We deserve to get out and keep helping people escape the...
Something came clanking down the chimney and smashed into Mimo's hands.
Ah!
He yelled in pain.
Damn, that hurt! What was that?
Pino aimed the miner's lamp on the ground. A chunk of ice the size of two fists lay in the dirt. Then he noticed shadows wavering on the walls and the dirt around the ice chunk. He went to the chimney stub, put his hand to it, and felt a small but steady chill draft.
"We've got air,"
he said, hugging his brother. Mr. D'Angelo said, "And now we dig out?" "And now we dig out," Pino said.
"You think you can?"
Mrs. Napolitano said. "No other choice," Pino said, looking up the chimney tube, seeing pale light, and remembering how high the chimney stuck out of the roof. Then he looked at the open door and the wall of white debris that clogged the entrance. The top of the door frame was low, 1.5 meters. He imagined a tunnel angling upward. But how long? Mimo must have been thinking along the same lines, because he said, "We've got at least 3 meters of digging." "More," Pino said. "We can't dig a shaft straight up. We're going to have to go at an angle to the door so we can crawl up it." 4. They used the ice axes, the hatchet, and the small metal shovel that came with the wood stove to attack the avalanche rubble. They dug at a 70-degree angle to the door frame, trying to bore out a passage big enough to crawl through. The first part of a meter was relatively easy. The snow was looser. Small blocks and gravel-sized streams of ice and debris came free with each strike of the axe.
"We'll be out before dark,"
Mimo said, shoveling the snow back into the deepest part of the hut. Pino's carbide lamp died, leaving them all in pitch blackness.
"Shit,"
Mimo said.
"Mommy,"
Anthony whined. Mrs. Napolitano said,
"How will we see to dig?"
Pino lit a match, dug in his pack, and came out with 2 devotional candles. He had 3. So did Mimo. He lit them and placed them above and beside the doorway. They no longer had the strong glow of the headlamp to rely on, but their eyes soon adjusted to the flickering light. And they set at the avalanche debris again, chopping and picking at what now felt like a monolithic block of snow and ice. Superheated by the friction created in the avalanche, the debris had become as solid as cement in places. Progress ground to a crawl, but every chunk removed was a cause for celebration, and slowly the tunnel began to form. Wider than Pino's shoulders, first 1 meter, then almost 2 meters long. They took turns, the man up front chipping at the ice and snow, and the other 2 moving the snow out into the hut, where the D'Angelo family and Mrs. Napolitano were crowded into a corner, watching the snow mound grow.
"Will we have enough room for all the snow?"
the pregnant violinist asked.
"If we have to, we'll start up the stove and melt some of it," Pino said.
By 8 o'clock that evening, they were, by Pino's estimate, 4 meters out from the door when he had to call it quits. He couldn't swing the axes anymore. He had to eat and to sleep. They all had to eat and to sleep. He divided the remaining provisions in the packs while Mimo and Mr. D'Angelo reassembled the stove. He apportioned 1/2 of the provisions into 6 shares, and they ate dried meat, dried fruit, nuts, and cheese. They drank more tea and huddled together before Pino lit the stove and blew out the 3rd-to-last candle. Twice during the night, he dreamed of being buried alive in a casket, and he awoke with a start, listening to the others' breathing and the tick, tick, tick of the stove cooling. Snow had melted into the dirt floor, and he knew he'd soon be lying in chill mud. But he was so tired, and his muscles so sore and cramped, he didn't care, and slept 3rd time. Mimo budged him hours later. He had the 2nd-to-last candle lit.
"It's 6 a.m., his brother said. "Time to get out of here."
It was cold again. Pino's bones ached. Every joint was sore. But he set about dividing up the last of the food and the water he'd melted on the stove the night before. Mr. D'Angelo went into the tunnel first. He lasted 20 minutes. Mimo lasted 30, and slid out of the tunnel, soaked from sweat and melting ice.
"I left the axe and the candle up there," he said. "You'll have to relight it."
Pino crawled back up the tunnel, now 5 meters long by his estimate. When he hit the wall, he rolled over and lit one of his last 4 matches. The candle was dwindling. He attacked the snow and ice with a fury. He chopped, stabbed, and broke chunks of the snow. He scooped, pushed, and kicked the frozen debris behind him.
"Slow down," Mimo called 30 minutes into the ordeal. "We can't keep up."
Pino paused, gasping like he'd run a long race, and glanced at the candle, now barely a stub and sputtering against drips of water falling every so often from the ceiling of the tunnel. He reached up and moved the candle over, set it on a ledge he cut with the axe. Then he set to chopping again, at a slower rhythm than before and with more strategy. He looked for the cracks in the surface and tried to cut into them. Pieces began to peel off in triangular and otter-shaped slabs, 10 or 12 centimeters thick. "The snow's different," he thought, running the granules through his hand. It was breakable, and the crystals were almost all faceted like his mother's finest jewelry. He sat there, thinking that this kind of snow could cave in from above. As they were chopping their way through that solid block of snow and ice, he'd never considered that the ceiling could collapse. Now it was all he could think about, and it froze him.
"What's the problem?" Mimo called, as he crawled up the tunnel behind him.
Before Pino could reply, the candle's flames sputtered and died, sending him back into total darkness. He buried his face in his hands, finally overwhelmed by the feeling that he, like the candle, was about to die and go black. Waves of emotion, fear, abandonment, and disbelief crashed over him.
"Why?" he whispered. "What did we..."
"Pino!" Mimo shouted. "Pino, look up!"
Pino raised his head and saw that the tunnel had not gone pitch dark. A dull, silvery glow showed through the tunnel ceiling, and his tears of despair turned to joy. They were almost to the surface, but as Pino had feared, the hoary snow broke apart and caved in on him twice, forcing him to back up and dig out, before at last he pushed the axe forward and felt it break the final resistance. When he pulled the axe back, bright sunshine blazed in.
"I'm through!" he shouted. "I'm through!"
5. Mrs. Napolitano, Mrs. D'Angelo, and the children were cheering when he forced his head and then his shoulders up out of the snow crust. The storm had long passed, leaving cold mountain air that smelled delicious and tasted better. The sky was clear and cobalt blue. The sun had only just come over a ridge line to the east. 15 new centimeters of powder snow lay over the rubble field, which he figured was nearly 50 meters wide and 1,500 meters long. High above him on the Groperas crag, he could see a jagged fracture line in the snow. In places, the slide had stripped the mountain almost bare. Rock and dirt and small trees were mixed into the new snow. Seeing the destruction and getting a sense of the sheer power of the avalanche, he believed it was a miracle that they'd survived. Mrs. D'Angelo thought so too, as did her husband, who followed his children out. Mimo exited behind Mrs. Napolitano. Pino went back in, grabbed the skis and packs, and pushed them up the passage. When he emerged from the tunnel for the last time, he felt spent and filled with gratitude.
It is a miracle we got out. How else can you explain it?
What's that? Anthony asked, gesturing down the valley.
That, my friend, is Val d'Illay, Pino said. And those mountains over there? That's Pizzo Emmett and Pizzo Palu. Way down below those peaks and those trees there, Italy becomes Switzerland.
It looks far, Judith said.
About 5 kilometers, Pino said.
We can do it, Mr. D'Angelo said. Everybody helps everybody.
I can't,
Mrs. Napolitano said. Pino turned to find the pregnant violinist sitting on a snow boulder, one hand on her belly and the other holding her instrument case. Her clothes were coated in frost.
Sure you can, Pino said.
She shook her head, started to cry.
All this, it's too much. I'm spotting blood.
Pino didn't understand until Mrs. D'Angelo said,
The baby, Pino.
His gut fell. She was going to lose the baby? Out here?
Oh, God. No, please no.
You can't move? Mimo asked.
I shouldn't move at all,
Mrs. Napolitano said. But you can't stay here, Mimo said. You'll die.
And if I move, my child might die.
You don't know that.
I can feel my body telling me so.
But if you stay, you'll both die here, Mimo insisted.
It's better, the violinist said. I could not live if my baby were to die. So go.
No, Pino said. We are getting you to Switzerland like we promised Father Ray.
I won't take a step,
Mrs. Napolitano shouted hysterically. Pino decided to stay with her and send on the others with Mimo, but then he looked around, thought a moment, and said, Maybe you don't have to take a step. He dropped his pack and put on his long wooden skis with leather and steel cable bear trap bindings. He played with them until they were tight around his boots. Ready? He said to Mrs. Napolitano.
Ready for what?
Get up on my back, Pino said. I'm taking you piggyback.
On skis?
She said, terrified.
I've never been on skis in my entire life.
You were never buried in an avalanche before either, Pino said. And you won't be on skis. I will. She stared at him doubtfully.
What if we fall?
I won't let that happen, he said, with all the confidence of a 17-year-old who'd been skiing almost as long as he'd been walking. She didn't move. I'm giving you a chance to save your baby and be free, Pino said, pulling the violin case from his pack.
What are you doing with my Stradivarius?
She asked. Staying balanced, Pino said, holding out the case in front of him as if it were the wheel of a car. Like an orchestra, your violin will lead us. 6. There was a moment's pause where Mrs. Napolitano looked to the sky and then stood up out of the snow, shaking with fear. Hold my shoulders, not my neck, Pino said, turning his back to her again. And wrap your legs tight around my waist. Mrs. Napolitano grabbed his shoulders. He squatted, got his arms behind her knees, and helped her up onto the small of his back. She got her legs around him, and he let go of them. She didn't feel that much heavier than his pack. Think like a jockey on a horse, Pino said, bringing the violin up in front of him and holding it lengthwise. And don't let go.
Letting go? No, never. Absolutely the farthest thing from my mind.
Pino felt a glimmer of doubt, but then shook it off, shuffled his feet, and aimed the skis downhill toward the outer edge of the avalanche field, some 30 meters away. They began to slide. There were bumps and ragged chunks of ice sticking up out of the newer snow. He tried to avoid them as they picked up speed.
but then one loomed unavoidably in their way. They went right up over the top of it and launched, sailing through the air.
Ah!
Mrs. Napolitano screamed. Pino landed awkwardly, skis askew, and for a second he thought the boards were going to get away from him, and that he and the pregnant violinist were going to twist and fall hard into the frozen debris. But then he saw they were going to collide with a stump. He did an instinctual hop move to his left, avoiding the stump, and then another. The two moves restored his equilibrium, and the skis accelerated. Pino and Mrs. Napolitano shot out of the debris field into fluffy powder snow. With the violin case thrust out in front of him, Pino grinned and began to churn his legs in unison, driving them deeper into the snow and then relaxing them so his feet rose up under his hips as Father Ray had taught him. The movement unweighted him momentarily at the top of each turn, which allowed him to shift his weight and turn the skis almost effortlessly. The skis arced left and then right in long, linked curves, building speed and blowing through snowdrifts that exploded and showered their faces. Mrs. Napolitano hadn't said a word in many seconds. He figured she'd stopped looking and was simply hanging on for dear life.
"Whee!"
she cried in his ear.
"It's like we're birds, Pino. We're flying!"
Mrs. Napolitano giggled and made whoop noises every time they dropped off a knoll. He felt her chin press down on his shoulder and understood she could see where they were going as he powered his skis in long, floating, lazy S-turns downslope toward the frozen lake and the woods and freedom beyond. Pino realized he would lose vertical drop soon. The way would flatten ahead. Even though his thighs were on fire, he pointed the skis straight down the last steep pitch, straight at that forested triangle of Italy that stuck into Switzerland. Pino wasn't turning now. No slalom here. He was doing straight line downhill, violin out front for balance, crouched in a semi-tuck. The skis hissed and rode up on top of the snow. They hurtled down that last pitch 30, 40, maybe 50 kilometers an hour, one twitch of a knee away from disaster. He saw the transition where the hill met the flat and brought his legs up under him again to absorb it. They shot past the lake. Pino stayed low, cutting the wind, and they almost made the tree line. When they came to a halt, they were less than a snowball's throw away. 7. They were both quiet for a second. Then Mrs. Napolitano began to laugh. She unwrapped her legs from Pino's waist and let go of her grip on his shoulders. She got down and, holding her belly, knelt in the soft snow and began chortling like she'd never enjoyed anything so much in her life. Pino was caught up in her snorts and giggles. It was contagious. He fell beside her and laughed until he was crying.
"What a crazy thing we've done. Who would have..."
"Pino!" a man's voice called sharply.
Pino startled and looked up to see Mr. Bergstrom standing just inside the tree line. He was carrying his shotgun and looked concerned.
"We made it, Mr. Bergstrom!" Pino cried.
"You're a day late," Bergstrom said. "And get out of the open. Bring her into the woods where she can't be seen."
Pino sobered and took his skis off. He handed Mrs. Napolitano her violin. She sat up and hugged it, saying,
"I think everything's going to be all right now, Pino. I can feel it."
"Can you walk?" Pino asked.
"I can try," she said,
and he helped her to her feet. He held her hand and elbow and supported her through the snow to the path.
"What's wrong with her?"
Bergstrom asked when they'd slogged into the trees. Mrs. Napolitano explained about the baby and the spotting with a radiant glow on her face.
"But now I think I can walk however far you need me to."
"Not that far, several hundred meters," Bergstrom said. Once you're in Switzerland, I can build you a fire. I'll go down and come back for you with a sled.
A few hundred meters I think I can do, she said. And a fire sounds like heaven above. Have you ever skied, Mr. Bergstrom?
The Swiss man looked at her as if she were slightly addled, but he nodded.
Isn't it grand?
The violinist said.
Isn't it the greatest thing you've ever done?
Pino saw Mr. Bergstrom smile for the first time. They waited in the tree line, telling the Swiss man about the storm and the avalanche, and watching Mimo and the D'Angelos work their way slowly down the slope. Mrs. D'Angelo carried her daughter. Mr. D'Angelo had Pino's pack and poles, and his son trailed behind. It took them almost an hour in the deep snow to reach the flat above the lake. Pino skied out to meet them, took Judith up on his back, and brought her to the woods. They were soon all safely in the trees.
"Is this Switzerland?" Anthony asked.
"Not far," Bergstrom said.
After a brief rest, they set out toward the border, with Pino helping Mrs. Napolitano along the well-used path through the forest. When they reached the grove where Italy became Switzerland, they stopped.
"There," Mr. Bergstrom said. "You're safe from Nazis now."
Tears dribbled down Mrs. D'Angelo's cheeks. Her husband hugged her and kissed away her tears.
"We're safe, my dear," he said. "How lucky we are when so many others have..."
He stopped and choked. His wife stroked his cheek.
"How can we ever repay you?"
Mrs. Napolitano said to Pino and Mimo.
"For what?" Pino said.
"For what? You led us through that nightmare storm and got us out of that hut. You skied me down the side of that mountain."
"What else could we do? Lose our faith? Give up?"
"You? Never,"
Mr. D'Angelo said, now pumping Pino's hand.
"You're like a bull. You never give up."
Then he hugged Mimo. Mrs. D'Angelo did too, as did her children. Mrs. Napolitano hugged Pino the longest.
"A thousand blessings on your head for showing me how to fly, young man," she said. "I'll never forget that as long as I live."
Pino grinned and felt his eyes water.
"Neither will I." "Isn't there anything I can do for you?" she asked. Pino was about to say no, but he noticed her violin case. "Play for us as we go back into Italy. Your music will lift our spirits for the long climb and ski out." That pleased her, and she looked at Bergstrom.
"Is it okay?"
He said,
"No one here will stop you."
Standing there in the snowy woods, high in the Swiss Alps, Mrs. Napolitano opened her case and rosined her bow.
"What would you like to hear?"
For some reason, Pino thought of that August night when he and his father and Tullio and the Beltraminis had taken the train out into the countryside to escape the bombardment of Milan. "Nessun dorma," Pino said. "None shall sleep."
"I can play that one in my sleep, but I'll play it for you, con smania," she said, her eyes watering. "Go on now. No goodbyes among old friends."
Mrs. Napolitano played the opening strains of the aria so perfectly, Pino wanted to stay to hear the entire piece. But he and his brother had hours of effort ahead of them, and who knew what challenges they'd face. The boys shouldered their packs and set off through the woods. They lost sight of Mrs. Napolitano and the others almost immediately. But they could hear her playing beautifully, with passion, each note carrying through the thin, crisp, alpine air. They reached the tree line and put on their skis as she took the tempo up again
casting forth the melody of the triumphant aria like some radio wave that hit Pino in his heart and vibrated in his soul. He stopped at the head of the lake to listen to the distant crescendo and was deeply moved when the violin quieted. That sounded like love, Pino thought. When I fall in love, I think it will feel just like that. Incredibly happy, and using skins on his skis, Pino started uphill after Mimo, heading toward the north cirque of the Gropera in the brilliant winter sunshine. Chapter 12, April 26th, 1944. 1. Pino woke to a clanking sound. Nearly 2.5 months had passed since he'd led Mrs. Napolitano and the D'Angelo family into Switzerland. He sat up, grateful that Father Ray had let him sleep in after yet another trip to Val d'Ilay. He stood, noticing he didn't feel sore in the least. He never felt sore anymore. He felt good, strong, the strongest he'd ever been. And why not? He'd made at least a dozen more trips to Switzerland since Mrs. Napolitano had played for him and Mimo. Hearing the clanking noise again, he looked out the window. 7 oxen with bells around their necks were pushing and shoving against one another, trying to get at bales of hay that had been put out for them. When he'd had enough of watching them, Pino dressed. He was entering the empty dining hall when he heard male voices outside, shouting, yelling, and threatening. Alarmed, Brother Bormio came out of the kitchen. Together they went and opened the front door to Casa Alpina. Father Ray was standing there, just off the little porch, looking calmly into the barrel of a rifle. Wearing a newer red neckerchief around his neck, Tito looked over the rifle sight at the priest. The same 3 curs who'd been with Tito at the New Year's Eve party were standing behind him.
"I told your boys all winter to stop using the Emmet unless you're going to pay tribute. Help the cause of free Italy," Tito said. "I'm here to collect my money."
"Extorting a priest," Father Ray said. "You're coming up in the world, Tito." The man glared at him, flipped the safety on his rifle, and said,
"It's to help the resistance."
"I support the partisans," the priest said. "The 90th Garibaldi Brigade, and I know you're not with them, Tito. None of you are. I think you just wear the neckerchiefs because they suit your purposes."
"Give me what I want, old man, or so help me, I'll burn your school down and then kill you and all your brats."
Father Ray hesitated. "I'll get you money and food. Put the gun away." Tito studied the priest a second, his right eye twitching. His tongue flicked to the corner of his mouth. Then he smiled, lowered the gun, and said,
"You do that, and don't be cheap about it, or I'll just have myself a look around inside. See what you really got."
Father Ray said, "Wait here." The priest turned and saw Bormio, and behind him Pino. Father Ray walked inside and said, "Get them 3 days' rations."
"Father?" the cook said.
"Do it, brother, please," Father Ray said as he moved on. Brother Bormio reluctantly turned and followed the priest, leaving Pino in the doorway. Tito caught sight of him, smiled slyly, and said,
"Well, look who we got here. My old pal from the New Year's Eve bash. Why don't you come on out? Say hello to me and the boys."
"I'd rather not," Pino said, hearing the anger in his voice and not caring.
"Rather not?"
Tito said, and aimed the gun at him.
"You don't have a choice, now do you?"
2.
Pino hardened. He really hated the guy. He walked out and off the little porch. He stood there facing Tito and stared stonily at him and his gun.
"I see you're still wearing the boots you stole from me," he said. "What do you want this time? My underwear?"
Tito licked at the corner of his lips, glanced down at the boots, and smiled. Then he stepped forward, swinging the butt of his rifle stock up hard. It caught Pino in the testicles, and he went down in agony.
"What do I want, kid?" Tito said. "How about a little respect for someone trying to rid Italy of the Nazi filth?"
Pino curled up in the slush, fighting not to puke.
"Say it," Tito said, standing over him.
"Say what?" Pino managed.
"That you respect Tito. That Tito is the partisan leader who runs things around the Splugen. And that you, boy, you answer to Tito."
As hurt as he was, Pino shook his head. Through gritted teeth, he said,
"Only one person runs things around here. Father Ray. I answer to him and God alone."
Tito raised his rifle, butt plate right above Pino's head. Pino was sure he was going to try to bash his skull in. He let go his testicles to guard his head and cringed for a blow that never came.
"Stop!" Father Ray roared. "Stop, or by God I'll call the Germans up here and tell them where to find you."
Tito threw the rifle to his shoulder and aimed it at Father Ray, who'd come off the porch.
"Give us up? That right," Tito said.
Pino lashed out his boot, kicked Tito flush on the kneecap. Tito buckled. The rifle discharged. The bullet went past Father Ray and smacked the side of Casa Alpina. Pino leaped on Tito and hit him once, hard, right on the nose, hearing it crunch and seeing it gush blood. Then he snatched up the rifle, stood, and cycled the action before pointing the gun at Tito's head.
"Stop this, damn it!" Father Ray said, stepping around in front of Pino, blocking him from Tito's men who were aiming at him. "I said I'd give you money for your cause and 3 days' food. Be smart. Take it. And go before something worse happens."
"Shoot him!"
Tito screamed, wiping blood on his sleeve and glaring at Pino and the priest.
"Shoot them both!"
For a breath, there was stillness and quiet and wondering. Then, one by one, Tito's men lowered their rifles. Pino exhaled with relief, winced at the dull fire still roaring between his legs, and aimed the gun away from Tito's face. He disengaged the clip and ran the bolt to eject the last bullet. Pino waited while Tito's men took the food and money. Two of them picked up Tito under his armpits, ignoring the curses and insults he hurled at them. Pino handed Tito's empty rifle to the third man.
"Load it! I'll kill them!"
Tito raged, as blood seeped over his lips and chin. "Let it go, Tito," one said. "He's a priest, for Christ's sake." The two men had Tito's arms across their shoulders and were doing their best to get him away from Casa Alpina. But the gang leader was straining to look back.
"This isn't over," Tito bellowed. "Especially for you, boy. This isn't done."
3. Pino stood next to Father Ray, shaken.
"Are you all right?" the priest asked.
Pino was quiet for a long time before saying, "Father, is it a sin if I'm asking myself if I did the right thing in not killing that man?"
The priest said, "No, it is not a sin. And you did the right thing not killing him."
Pino bobbed his head, but his lower lip was trembling,
and it was taking everything in his power to swallow the emotion surging in his throat. Everything had happened so fast, so... Father Ray patted Pino on the back.
Have faith. You did the right thing.
He nodded again, but couldn't meet the priest's gaze for fear of crying.
Where did you learn how to handle a gun like that? Father Ray asked.
Pino wiped at his eyes, cleared his throat, and said in a hoarse voice,
My Uncle Albert, he has a hunting rifle, a Mauser, kind of like that one. He taught me.
I can't decide if you were brave or foolhardy.
I wasn't going to let Tito kill you, Father.
The priest smiled and said,
Bless you for that. I wasn't ready to die today.
Pino laughed, winced, and said,
Me neither.
They went back inside the school. Father Ray got ice for Pino, and Brother Bormio made him breakfast, which he devoured.
You keep growing and we won't be able to keep up, Bormio grumbled.
Where's everyone else? Pino asked.
Skiing with Mimo, Father Ray said. They'll be back for lunch.
As he was eating his second helping of eggs, sausage, and black bread, two women and four children came timidly into the room, followed by a man in his 30s and two very young boys. Pino could tell in an instant they were new refugees. He'd come to recognize the expressions of hunted people.
Will you be ready to go again in the morning? Father Ray asked.
Pino shifted, felt a dull ache in his loins, but said,
Yes.
Good. And can you do me a favor?
Anything, Father, Pino said.
Go to the chapel tower and watch for the signal from Campo Dolcino, he said. You can take your books with you. Get some studying done. 20 minutes later, Pino gingerly climbed a ladder into the chapel tower. He had a book bag on his back, and his balls still ached. With the sun beating on the tower, it was surprisingly warm, too warm for the amount of clothing he was wearing. He stood on the narrow catwalk that went around the interior of the chapel spire, glancing at the void where the bell should have been. Father Ray had yet to install one. Pino opened a narrow shutter to look down through a slot in the cliff, which allowed him to see the upper two windows of the rectory in Campo Dolcino, over a kilometer below. Pino took off the book bag and dug out the binoculars Father Ray had given him. He peered through them, surprised again at just how close they made the rectory seem. He studied the two windows. Shades drawn. That meant a German patrol of some kind was in the Splugen drainage. They seemed to make the drive up and down the road to the pass near midday, give or take an hour. Pino checked his watch. It was 11:15. He stood there enjoying the warm spring air and watching birds flit among the spruce trees. He yawned, shook his head to clear the incredible desire to go back to sleep, and stared through the binoculars again. 30 minutes later, to his relief, the shades came up. The patrol had passed through, heading down the valley toward Chiavenna. Pino yawned and wondered how many more refugees would come to Motta tonight. If there were too many, they'd have to split up. He'd take one group and Mimo the other. His brother had done a lot of growing up in the last few months. Mimo was less a brat, and as tough as anyone in the mountains. Pino realized for the first time that he saw his younger brother as his best friend, closer even than Carletto. But he wondered how Carletto was, and how Carletto's mother was, and Mr. Beltramini. He looked down at the catwalk, eyes drooping. He could lie down there,
make sure he wouldn't fall off, and snooze in the nice, warm...
No, he decided. He could fall off and break his back. He'd go down the ladder, sleep in